Hello, everyone. My name is Giorgio Impanoff, and I'm the founder of Global Celebration. And I want to invite you to jump on New Numa Godcast. It's a powerful podcast with Norman Brown. You will love it. Norman is a great host, and I appreciate Norman. Appreciate you, what you're doing. Love you, man.
Hey, this is Bill Vanderbush, and I want to encourage you to check out my friend Norman Brown and his podcast called New Numa, and you can go to newnuma.com to find it. It's P-N-E-U-P-N-E-U-M-A.com. Norman talks about everything from identity to grace to diversity to unity to reconciliation, and his desire really is the same as what's on my heart, and that is to bring people together, to be the kingdom of God, to express the love and grace of Jesus here on the earth. I highly encourage you to check out Norman Brown and the New Numa podcast.
What's good, New Numa family? Do you subscribe to or believe in what we discuss on New Numa Godcast? If you do, while I got your attention, hit that subscribe button. It'll mean a lot to us. Peace. First of all, welcome to New Numa Godcast, Georgia. And it's good to finally have you on the show, because I know we've been talking about doing this for a couple of years now. And, you know, it's good to finally be able to do this. And before we really get into it, I just want to kind of tell the audience, like, how you and I connected. And you may not remember this, but there was about, I think this was like 2016 or 17. It was probably 16, actually, because it was a church in Maryland. And I think it was called the Vine or Vineyard or something like that. And there was a special thing that they were doing there, and you were there you were one of the speakers at this conference or whatever they were calling it. And Rich Brink brought me up to you. So Rich and I had already, you know, had a friendship before that, and then he introduced me to you. I don't know if you remember that or not, but that was how we initially got connected. And ever since then, you know, I was just really like, I really wanted to hear your story, because I heard things here and there, and I was like really interested in it. So let's start from the beginning, because, you know, everybody likes to know the origin of people. And I know that you grew up in Bulgaria, and I just wanted you to talk a little bit about, like, how was it in your family life growing up as a child in Bulgaria?
Well, of course, most people know Bulgaria was part of the Soviet Union, the socialistic communist world, and growing up where, so that's the background, the political setting. And most people don't realize how ruthless the communists are. I mean, most people know that Hitler is a bad guy, right? Really, really bad, and killed so many people and so forth. But growing up in a communist, they're just fascists like Hitler and Lenin and Stalin, are just as ruthless. In fact, probably even more ruthless than Hitler. So just a really murderous type of government that established themselves by sheer force of killing. And the number one enemies for them was, for communism, is capitalism. I'm not sure if people are familiar with that, but that's what it is, you know. And so they, in order to get established they practically killed all the capitalists. And even like Stalin would order people, his police and people, the army, to kill even people wearing glasses. You say, well, why is that? Well, because back then in the early 30s and 40s, not everybody wore glasses because it was expensive. And if you wore glasses, that means that you were wealthy and money. And also, it meant that you read. Most likely, you know, use glasses to reading. And if you're reading, it means that you're smart, you know, smarter than others, whatever. And so just kill them. Guys with glasses, get rid of them because there'll be competition. So anyways, wow. I don't want to go on to that, but just paint the picture, you know, of the background of where I grew up. Now, the communists had established their regime by, I think, 1944, particularly in Bulgaria, after the World War II, as Hitler is being defeated, the Russian army took over most of, you know, Eastern Europe, like starting up north from Poland to, of course, East Germany and Hungary and Czechoslovakia, Romania, and Bulgaria in the south. They just kind of finished at that. So all that became Eastern Europe, communist Eastern Europe. So I was born there, you know, politically. And the second thing that was rough for me as a kid, mom and dad divorced. They started separating when I was five or six, I'd say six. And then the final divorce ended up around seven or eight. So I grew up with mom, which she was great, powerful, hardworking, single mom. But growing up without a dad is not good. And my dad was not a bad guy. I actually liked him. But he never came to see me, not even once, my entire childhood. So I had that void, you know, in my heart about that. So I grew up, my personality and character and everything just was shaped with that. And of course today, many people are raised with single mom, and many understand that, they relate to that. And that is how I started my life. Yeah.
So basically, you know, this is kind of, I wasn't really expecting that in a sense, because I was thinking, like, you know, back in that time, it seemed like families were much stronger. But, you know, I guess going through a communist society, I'm not sure how much that helps marriages. But I know that, I mean, I'm sure it doesn't help them. But, you know, as far as, like, the effect of that on a family, I'm sure that if it affects families even worse in that type of society than it does in a capitalistic or, you know, any other types of societies that exist.
Yeah.
So
free market.
I guess, what was the climate like for youth growing up? Because it seems like, obviously, in a society like that, there isn't much freedom to do anything. So as a teenager, I know that a lot of times, especially here in America, you know, teenagers, they use that time to explore themselves, to discover themselves. They're doing a lot of, you know, different things to be different. They want to, you know, experiment with things and whatnot. But what was that like as a teenager in that type of environment?
Yeah. Just a little note on the thing you mentioned about back then the families were stronger. And that's probably true to most, I mean, obviously in America, that's the 40s, 50s, and even early 60s, families were stronger. And then the whole rock and roll era, things begin to, you know, slowly deteriorate. And then, but in Bulgaria, and not just Bulgaria, but Russia and communist countries in general, the communists are, of course, we said that they're enemy number one is capitalists. That was Karl Marx's idea, in order to establish socialism and communism, you have to destroy capitalism. And I see that happening here, at least they're attempting. So family, on the other hand, Norm, is another stronghold, another strength that people have, being married, an agreement and so forth, and children. So communists don't believe in family because it's not as easy to control, families as to control divided families, let's say, or even separated families like mine and divorced families. That was way easier to control. So they, for instance, they believe that the only way to run society, they're like politically, they believe in control and slavery, basically. To them, people are just to be used, and that's it. So they invented this whole thing that children belong to the state, and so they start to build these large children's homes, not orphanages. They just want, let's say, a woman to birth the child, and in the first 2-3 years raise it, and then let the states raise it, and she goes to work. So moms were generally guided into, all right, birth your kid, and then turn it over to us. You go to work. So that's the tactic or the strategy in order to control better, their country. They invented that children are not property of the family, but they're property of the state. I hear that going on today. I hear that teachers' unions are greatly very radical. They want to control children, and so there. I hear this term, children, the moment they step into school, sort of like, mom and dad, back off. We'll see you tonight. But for now, the kids are in our control. And anyways, I hope that's not that doesn't really happen fully. I'm sure they're trying, but in Bulgaria, that was the reality. So parents were afraid to talk anything to kids other than what the propaganda and what the state says. Because, they fear of being taken away, being arrested, being tormented, and eventually disappear, being killed if you disagree, what I'm saying. So that much I wanted to say about this, what you mentioned, that you're surprised that I'm, talk about kind of a soft, weak family. But that's how it was. As far as teenagers, it's kind of a, you feel restricted, you feel like not much, if you want to call it fun, and not much, I don't know. For me, it was very cold, unfriendly, and, the teachers were not very friendly, loving. They were more strict and not so loving. So, anyways, I'm not sure if I'm answering, but my childhood wasn't very, very happy, and as a teenager, I was very withdrawn and not very social. And the only time I came alive to, society, so to speak, is when I heard the sound of the Beatles back in 62 or 63, maybe, something like that. And me and three boys started a band to imitate this this new sound, this the Beatles sound, and we found it to be incredible. And yet, it was not easy to gather information. Like we couldn't listen to, like they wouldn't play. It was a very shut down society. You couldn't get stuff from the West very easy at all. It was like only things that would be smuggled by the black market, if you can imagine. Even magazines, the Western magazines, were very few, because they would confiscate, they were trying to isolate us from the West, you know what I mean, from the free countries. And the only way we can hear the sound of Beatles and this early pop rock and roll things is through what, I don't know if you heard of shortwave radio.
Like yes, in America, I was about to say that, yeah.
Oh, right. I mean, most stations are FM, right? That's the FM. But in Bulgaria, there's, well, in the world, of course, there's a shortwave wave and I guess midwave and long wave, but the shortwave actually go the farthest. They can practically go around the world if they have the proper, station. But shortwave radios is the only way we could hear the Western sounds, you know what I mean, of music and rock and roll and so forth. Even though it was jammed heavily, I'm using that term, they create these noises, you know, like that, really, and try to block the shortwave sound. And it comes and goes, you know, and they couldn't consistently block it 100%, but it'll go in waves, like, it'll be like, you hear the sound and for about maybe a minute or less, and then comes the sound noises for about 60 seconds, and then you can hear a little bit better again, and they'll go down into those noises. It's weird. It's hard to describe, but that's how we could hear a little bit, bits and pieces of songs, and also news. You know, the way I did it is the way I knew even how to do it, because my grandpa would be listening to, late at night, would be listening to the shortwave news from, there was two big stations that provided real news, you know, other than the Russian news. It's like fake news. They're just lying constantly. But the Radio Free Europe was a big source, big station, and the Voice of America. Those two big stations, and they would penetrate through the noises, and my grandpa, you know, would hear some bits and pieces of the news of the day late at night, you know, and listening to shortwave radio. And that's how, then when he goes to bed and sleep, finally I listen a little bit to the music sessions or whatever. So that's how we, and then eventually we gather with three of the young people, and we were all like in different homes, parents' homes or somebody else's homes. We would get together and all night listen to the shortwave radios. That's how we gather the information for music.
Wow, that's pretty interesting. I mean, I've been familiar with shortwave radio for years, but I didn't realize that, you know, this was something that was used in other countries for that type of a purpose. But one thing that's kind of an interesting fun fact to know about me is that I was actually interviewed on Voice of America back in like,
really?
2001. Yeah, I was on there because I was published in a book called Steelworkers, Lives, and Legends. And it was called The Heat. It was called The Heat, Steelworkers, Lives, and Legends. And I wrote something in that book. And they interviewed me on Voice of America based on that book. And so, yeah, that was kind of interesting. But it's kind of, I was thinking about the fact that being in a country like that where it's communism going on, I was really curious, how in the world did you get instruments? Like, were they just, were they like, because I know, like, from what I've seen and heard, it seems as though they tried to direct kids to do certain things, like certain types of jobs or whatever, and they, like, prep them for that as they get older. How were you able to get a hold of musical instruments to even have a band?
Well, it was a good question. What the guys did, what we all did, I ended up becoming the drummer for the band because that was the only sort of vacancy. The other guitarists, the two guitarists and the bass were taken, right? So in order to be part of the band, I had to accept the drummer. So I learned how to play drums. But the guitars were all handmade. Everything except the tuning keys, you know, from classical guitar, they will take, because there was a classical guitar before. It was not electric, of course, but it was acoustic. So the tuning keys, they'll take it from the classical guitar. Practically everything else was made by hand. Everything. They'll take a piece of wood, cut it like the rock guitars in that shape, and then build the everything. Everything was by hand. And even, you know, the pickups for the electric guitar.
Yeah.
It was, you know, they're like a little magnet inside, and they were wound up by hand. It's like the electric little cords around the magnets. Everything was done by hand, you know.
Wow.
And the amplifiers were really old radios, like the German radios, Telefunken and whatever, you know, Philips and other radios. They were converted to be as like an amplifier for the electric guitar. It was, everything was funky, but you know, it worked, and that's how we started. It took several years before we could actually buy a guitar professionally made from the West, and an amplifier. Oh my gosh, that was a like revolution for us when we got the first electric guitar from England, like Vox, you know. Vox was like, my gosh, and we were like so impressed, you know.
Wow.
And
well,
amplifiers
that,
were a big deal. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, that shows the ingenuity that comes out of people when they really want to do something, when they're in a tight situation like that, where they're able to be creative and start to do things to be able to achieve their end goal. And that's amazing that you were able to do that. So being that you started this band, I know you didn't know this about me, but I also come from a musical background, and I played the saxophone when I was in high school and also middle school. And so I'm very familiar with, you know, classical, jazz, pop, all those kind of styles of music. I played them in school. So, but yeah, I was just curious. I know that you started this band and everything. Did it ever get to a point where actually within the country that you made any kind of money doing that? Because I'm thinking, if you're in a communist country, how do you even make money doing that?
Well, at first they put us through restrictions and rules, but they allow us to exist because they couldn't figure out, you know, what we were sort of. And we were interesting young people and very interesting sounds. They didn't allow us to sing any Beatles songs or anybody Western songs because they don't want the influence in English. So our first shows, so to speak, it was one that we did in a national television and they recorded us for 30 minutes, and we played like, I don't know, like five or six songs. They were instrumental. So they will only allow us instrumental stuff. So that way we don't sing anything Western. Then they said, if you want to play and if you want to sing songs, then you have to use like a communistic type songwriting that you know, it's just neutral, it doesn't have the Western influence. And our escape from some of these rules was the folklore music, because there were folklore music was accepted, you know. It was like kind of like jazz. It was accepted. And so we would put rock beats and like chord progressions that were Western and with the Western style, but we kind of sang or sort of came under the cover of the folklore, but we prepped it up with rock beats and electric guitars, if that makes any sense. And that was that was accepted. They allow us. It was a cat and mouse game, exactly. And they were even, you know, even in the studio, they will come during the mix. Last process, right? In the studio, you do the mix, and after it's been recorded, they just mix it and get it ready for it, you know. And they will control how much drum we can put, because to them, drum was, you know, edgy, and how much also distortion we can put in the guitar. Everything. They just try to moderate us and soften us so we're not as edgy and more popish, more softer, if you know. And that's how we started. We, you know, we cooperate, of course, because how else you gonna? You don't exist if you don't. If you don't, at least tell do what at least they tell it. As long as they allow us. Now our concerts were like we would have sort of, if you want to call it, underground concerts, meaning like not official by the system of concerts, because they had some old folk and classical system of concerts. And so we would go off of that and we'd go into a local clubs of sorts, local restaurants or something, and we would, you know, play, and they will kind of tolerate it. Now, once we became better and better, and once we became powerful, especially when the amplifiers came and the PA systems, we became very powerful. And I mean, we shook the crowd. And like, for instance, what do you call those? I forget the name, but at the end of the year, like May, did they have proms or something?
Remember? Oh yeah, graduation. Yeah,
graduation. So, or birthdays. We use these kind of birthdays or graduation or some of these official off the grid, and we would do high schools or students, colleges or universities, and we would play, and we'll be, you know, kind of doing it, not professional, but, you know, and one of those was our most powerful, influential three nights in this graduation thing. And that's when we became very, very powerful. And they realized that they made a mistake even to allow us to start, because we started a revolution practically, culturally speaking, revolution. So eventually they shut us down. They shut us down and say, no more rock and roll in Bulgaria, that's it. And put us under their control. And that, fortunately for me, that pushed me to decide to escape, to run away. I was fed up. I was fed up. And it's ironic because I'm not that kind of a revolutionary kind of guy as far as like politically, absolutely not. But culturally pushed me over the edge, man, I don't know how to say it. And I came up with the idea of somehow get out somehow. Because you have like a fence, like a, it's called Iron Curtain, but it's like a huge, you know, kind of like a wall of, you know, like a border wall. But with minefields and with electricity, I mean, it was impossible to, some places it's like impossible, people get killed and all that. And there was one spot where you heard of Serbia, right? That's current country.
Yeah.
But back then was Yugoslavia. I don't know if you heard that.
And, yeah, Yugoslavia.
Yugoslavia, which is divided now between Serbia and
Croatia.
Croatia, right. And exactly. And Kosovo. And
what about Bosnia? Is that part of that too?
Yeah, Bosnia. Bosnia. Yeah, Bosnia, Serbia, Kosovo, Croatia. Maybe there's a couple more. Slovakia, maybe. I'm not sure. Uh-huh. But anyways, that nation at the time called Yugoslavia, it was a union of about five or six little countries. That nation was the only nation from the communist side that was not, the leader's name is Tito, he was not 100% obedient to Russia. That's how I can describe it. And he did his own thing. He was technically communist, but he had his own version of it. He was semi-free, semi-communist, is one of those. And the way he achieved that, it was at the end of the World War II, right? Russians were invaded everywhere. And he was smart enough to, as soon as the World War II ended, like the victory day, whatever that was, forget it now, September 44, 1944, something like that. Yeah, like you call it D-Day. The final day where Hitler was totally defeated and victory, right? That night, this guy managed to pack all the Russian soldiers into trains. And before the general, before people can figure out what's going on, they were trained out of the nation. They were trained out. In the morning, they're waking up, and the Russian army is outside the border. So now, in order for that to come back, they have to invade, which is like a second war, right? So he was smart enough to get him outside his country. And because the American army and the, you know, allies, everything was all still there, right? Around Germany and everywhere. And it would have caused conflict. Bad conflict for Russia. So the Russians kind of wake up without, they're not inside that country, Yugoslavia. That's why somehow that country remained more neutral, not a bit. So why I tell the story is because that was the place to escape through that Iron Curtain, through that section of the Iron Curtain, where if you have a chance to run faster than the soldiers, they will not kill you. Everywhere else, you can get shot. Everywhere, Germany,
wow.
Poland, Romania, Hungary, you'll get shot. Some places they give you warning, shoot in the air, and then start killing you. But they will do that. But it's the Serbian government says, no, we won't kill people just from other countries. They're trying to escape because we don't believe in that. And that's when my rock and roll friend, my guitar friend, we found that out and we say, well, we'll get to Serbia and from Serbia we'll run fast. And that was our plan.
And, wow.
Yeah. Other things happened, earthquakes, but we were ready to run. That was our plan. Ended up, we found a black market smuggler, so they smuggled us, but we were ready to run.
So that's really interesting. I know I've heard of the Iron Curtain, but I didn't know it was an actual, like, wall or something like that that was called the Iron Curtain. So this thing, like, covered how much area did this cover? I mean, you got to have a lot of, you know, there has to be a pretty long, you know, wall to be covering all that land.
Yeah. Huge, long. I can't tell you, but it's like about 5 or 6 countries across.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy. So,
yeah.
So then after you escaped Bulgaria, how did you get to America?
Well, after we ran away across the Iron Curtain, we went into Vienna, and we turned ourselves in, and into there was like several immigrants kind of foundation that will help immigrants process them, and some a Catholic foundation and a couple others, but we heard about this Russian foundation called Tolstoy Foundation. So we went and talked to them and said, we escaped and we're here and we want to go to some countries. And we applied to, I think, Holland, England, and another one. And they kept denying us because by the end of the year, their quotas are met and they don't accept any more immigrants. Even Canada said no. So the only place that we had left to go was Australia and America. Of course, Australia is like down under, way far. So we thought maybe we'll try to see if the Americans will take us. And they took us in immediately. It was phenomenal how the American consulate welcomed us with open arms, practically. He stood up with open arms and said, he asked us, how did we get it? How did we get there? And we told him how we escaped, risking our life. He says, welcome home, boys. You're in the right place. Our country is made from like a freedom seeking, people like yourself. And so you're welcome home. That's what he said. It was amazing.
Wow. So, you know, one thing that I just thought about, I never thought about this before, but being that all these countries were basically under the Russian influence, were they all speaking Russian?
Yeah. Yeah, we were forced to speak Russian in school. I went through 8 years of Russian school. It's a mandatory language.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that's crazy. Well, I mean, I guess you still know Russian, right? I mean, even though you don't use it as much.
Actually, now I don't mind. I mean, obviously, now I'm grateful that I did learn some Russian. Because when you meet Russian people, you say, hello, I love you, how's it going, this and that. And that's good, you know, for communicating.
Okay.
But at the time, I hated obviously.
Yeah, I can imagine. So now I know that, you know, when you came to America at some point in time, you got involved in Christian life. But I know that you were initially still kind of into your music that you were doing and all that, right?
Yeah, well, first of all, I met the Jesus people in the Los Angeles area, and the Iron Curtain is 7,000 kilometers, 4,300 miles, 4,000 miles. That's how long it
is.
Huge.
Wow, that's crazy. So
and Yugoslavia is not in it. It's kind of neutral in the middle. That's what happened.
Okay.
That's what happened to us, yeah. Anyways. What were you saying?
So you were telling me about how you met the Jesus people. Now, I think at first when you came to America, you were still trying to pursue your music and things of that nature, or what? What was going on with that?
Yeah. I ended up, my first American job was in Florida, working on a sewer system in this Florida island, Bradenton Beach. And that's when me and my buddy that escaped, we found this, we met this American young guy our age, and he told us that up north, he's from Detroit, he says that in the fall, the car factories will hire people in a good paying job. So as soon as the job that we were at ended, we took off, drove to the north, and we got a job at the Ford car factory. And we worked in assembly lines for, I don't know, 3 months or something like that. And I got enough money to drive down to California, because that was the goal, to get to Hollywood and get together with the musical industry. And when I arrived in Hollywood, it wasn't what I thought it would be at all. It was a depressing, not a happy place. So that was, the Lord brought me to, I mean, I didn't go to Beverly Hills. I went to Hollywood and Vine. I mean, the rough street life, the famous boulevards with the stars, they were not shining at all. There was puke on them from the winos. There was hair and addicts shooting, prostitutes were walking. I mean, the nightlife of Hollywood is not... I wasn't at the nice places. I was in the street where the music studios were, actually, you know. And I had a rude awakening, you know. And I'm going, my gosh, I made a mistake. What the heck? What am I supposed to do now? And at the perfect time, when I was disoriented, you know, like, what do I do now? This is not. I mean, you know, I risked my life to get there. It was not worth dying for. I mean, I just got, what did I do? But what am I supposed to do now? I was out of sync, kind of. And at that point, when the Jesus people began to share in the streets, they were preaching and sharing about Jesus, and one of those little groups, they had like kind of like a, what you call a halfway house today, that they were like helping drug addicts and street situations. And they were all former drug addicts, basically. But the courts will give them a break. In fact, the guy that led him to the Lord was formerly, I don't know, heroin addict or coke addict, I can't remember what, but he had like something like $500, $600 a day habit, $500. And
wow.
that was what he had to snort or whatever every day. So he had to get so he was robbing people. I mean, he had to carry a gun to try to get money from people for his habit, right? And he said that when they arrested him, finally got him and put him in, also he was dealing drugs as well, So they put him in jail, and then in jail, Jesus showed up. And so I'm going, wait a minute, I don't know anything about religion, but I remember seeing these, like, what do you call them here? The Catholic churches, right? They're like these large cathedrals, right? Well, we had similar to that in Bulgaria. It's not Catholic, it's Orthodox churches. And so but it's similar. They have kind of like the large buildings with paintings, religious paintings on the walls, right? So I was familiar with some of these paintings. They were kind of like a museum almost, spiritually really dead. But those paintings from the past, they were describing the life of Jesus and whoever else there and doing some healing, you know, healing the lepers or healing the cripples or something. It's all paintings. So, and Jesus was around with like a halo on his head and sort of like some sort of a sainthood or something like that. So in other words, he was a good guy and did good things for people, and that's what you could see by the painting. So for you to tell me that Jesus that I remember seeing in these pictures is today alive and then come to a jail. It's like, it doesn't make sense, right? It's just like, if he would be today, he'll be not go to the jail, Sarah. He'll be with the nice people or whatever. Anyways, I don't know. It was my kind of crazy thinking. But I dismissed his whole story. Like, I don't know what you're talking about. That's kind of a crazy thing. So beside the talking, they offer some food, you know, and the food was great. Their dinner was nice. And so they invited me again, they actually tried to play some music to me. Some of them were musicians. They were not very good at all. So I was like, forget your music. But your food was great. That saved the day. The food was really, really good. And thank God for the chef, the cook. he provided that draw factor that could go back. And over for 2 months practically, I would stop in around 6 o'clock, go over their house, free dinner, and then that kind of did it. Because of that, I felt, after a while, you felt like, look, that's not good what you're doing. You're eating the guys' food. You don't agree with anything they're saying. You don't believe in any of that. So why don't we just quit that and just get to Hollywood and try to do what you got to do to make it, whether you like it or not. It's just, that's all you know, music. So, and the day I'm saying tomorrow, I'm leaving, and that's it, tomorrow. So I packed my little bag and I said, I'm leaving tomorrow, but tonight, just out of respect for all the cooking and stuff, I'll give this God a chance. Now, I know there's no God, but these guys kept insisting that there is, and I know there isn't, but all right, just because they've been nice to you, and because they've been generous to you, they've been loving to you and hospitable, go and say something to this God that, you know, doesn't exist. And get it over with. And then, you know, you've closed the chapter, because for 2 months, all that kindness has been growing, you know, growing and growing, and it's messing with me, you know. and that's just go on that mountain up there and get it over with. And so I went in the mountain completely like, why am I doing it? But, you know, out of obligation, you know what I'm saying? And so I go on a mountain and I'm going, okay, say something and just get it over with. And so the thought came to say, God, do you exist? When that thought came, I go, well, that's a good way to prove he doesn't. Go ahead, say it and get it over with. And I did. I said, God, do you exist? And the moment the phrase came out of my mouth, Brother God came on me with a force, like his presence became really, really tangible. Really tangible.
Wow.
It's tick. I mean, you know, you're a musician, so you know when you change from one room to another, the acoustics are different. The acoustics
change.
I went inside of a tent or some sort of a canopy came over me. I mean, it's a change because I kept going, what's going on? What the heck? Like, what is this? And everything changed around me in such a tangible way that I'm going, could this be God? Because it's so, you know, I couldn't see it, but I can feel it. Almost even the air got thick. Like, what is happening? And that's when, and then I hit the deck. I hit the dirt. I fell. I was overwhelmed by the discovery or the sense that he exists. And I collapsed, man. I collapsed in that dirt. And shook and shook and shook and cried and God, whatever this is, I don't know, but I want to know everything about this God. And it just dawned on me because communists are liars, right? They lied about everything. They lied. They lied about everything, and they said there's no God, right? Communists raised it that way. There's no God. So they must have lied about God because these guys, the good guys, and they were nice to me, and they said there is a God, and there it is. I'm feeling something. I'm sensing something. That must be God, whatever that is. And I want to know.
So I got a question.
I want to
ask you a question after you finish that.
Yeah, I'm finished. I mean, I shook. It got dark, and I went down at their house, and man, they could see something happened to me, and I didn't care about the food. I didn't go to the kitchen anymore. I stayed with them, and they were singing some worship songs in the evening to the Lord, and just a home praise and worship gathering. And I collapsed there with them on the floor, and I felt like God put His arms around me. I felt like it. It was amazing. That was my first day of discovery of God's existence. You know.
So. You know, the thing that I'm really finding to be interesting is that you said that they had these so-called churches that were Orthodox, which I don't know exactly what that means, but they keep telling you God doesn't exist. So how did they even have Orthodox churches over there? What were they teaching if they didn't teach that God existed?
Oh, okay. First of all, those buildings, they were from the old days. They were like built way before the communists. I mean, communists came 1944, right? The end of World War II. These buildings were 200 or 300 years old, maybe even more. Some of them even older. And
oh, wow.
like one of the primary buildings of Orthodox, meaning Russian Orthodox, Greek Orthodox, you know, Europe was divided by two main religions. One is Catholic in the West, and in the East, Orthodox. That's it. And they're similar, very, very similar. Actually, they're not very different. Yeah, they're not very different. Very similar. They have the Orthodox have a little more like the Catholic light candles too, no, because the Orthodox light candles a lot, and also the priest has some sort of an incense censers like that. The Orthodox are a little more like the Old Testament. They have, anyways, the clothing, kind of like an Old Testament priest. They have these censers, and they have an altar and stuff like that. And that was the kind of like an old tradition, right? So when the communists came, they decided apparently not to destroy these buildings because they were very old, and partly, because Russia was also Orthodox religion, and the communists, like for instance, we were before the communism, like in 1800, Bulgarians were under Muslim, Turkish, for 500 years, we were slaves to the Muslims. And we were in the Turkish yoke of slavery, that's what it is. Kind of like Israel was 400 years under Pharaoh, we were like 500 years under the Muslim. And we were a Christian country, originally. Nothing about that, but, if you want to go back history, Bulgaria was formed 6th century by Bulgars, tribes from Asia. We were like part Asian. When I say Asia, I don't mean China. I mean more like Mongolia, down below, horsemen, like warrior guys. Genghis Khan, I don't know if you heard of them. But anyway, there were horse people that invaded, and they was going on the horses, warriors, and looking for places to go, and they landed in Bulgaria, one tribe, let's say, and they did a peaceful merger with the local natives.
Thanks for listening to the New Godcast once again. This is your host Norm. Follow me at Norm the Professor on IG. I'm in agreement for power and breakthrough in your life. Keep tuning in every week for that real talk, new life.